Good morning, good day, good evening, or good night. My name is Jeremiah, and you are listening to Christian Anarchy.
Begin with concluding remarks. Pick up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it. Nervously saying words, little surprising bend. A mark beneath the chin.
Welcome to episode 2. I hope you are feeling as fine as you look today. Put your thinking caps on, get your volume to the correct levels, and let's get going. We have a lot to get through today, and we only have as long as I would like to take to get through it. So no rush, I guess. Today, we are going to talk about self-ownership. This is the crazy notion that people own themselves. People are in charge of their own bodies. They rule themselves. This is a fairly simple concept, but an important one for anarchy. We are going to discuss 4 aspects of self-ownership today, and then talk about how government violates these aspects of self-ownership. Finally, we will carry on our conversation from last week about Genesis and discuss some stories in light of ownership. The 4 parts of self-ownership we are going to discuss are as follows. People own themselves. People own their actions and the consequences of their actions. People own the fruit of their labor. And people own their relationships with other people. Let's begin with people owning themselves. Your body belongs to you, and my body belongs to me. I don't own you, and you don't own me. No one owns us but ourselves. I suspect this is neither a surprising concept nor an idea which many would disagree with, but also, many listeners will agree with the concept and disagree with some of its implications. This basic idea of self-ownership is a part of the reason we think of all sorts of things as evil. It would be nearly universally considered wrong for a woman to adult nap me, lock me up in a dungeon, and beat me daily. Why? I own myself, and she does not own me. If the same woman went to a store, bought a doll, locked it up in a dungeon, and beat it daily, then she has not wronged anyone. While her behavior is certainly odd, somewhat disturbing, and an indicator of psychosis, she has done nothing evil because she owns the doll. Ownership foundationalizes much of human ethics. No person has a right to tell another what they can and cannot do with their own body, so long as the person is not violating the non-aggression principle discussed in the last episode, that is, not initiating coercion through force, theft, or fraud. To use coercion to make someone do what you want them to do is to declare ownership over them. It is to exercise ownership over their body and their choices. People should not be owned by other people. If people own themselves, then they can expect to use their body as they wish without interference from others. Because people are not owned by other people, they are free to do with and to their body whatever they would like. If one wishes to run, they run. If one wishes to sleep, they sleep. If one wishes to consume something, they consume it. If they wish to change location, they move. Whatever one wishes to do, they can do, so long as they are not violating the self-ownership of others. Self-ownership demarcates the boundaries of what we are free to do and what others are free to do to us. No one owns us, so we can do what we want. No one owns us, so no one has the right to force us to do something we don't want to do. A society which recognizes self-ownership treats people with dignity. Self-owned people are free people. People own their actions and the consequences of their actions. This is another self-evident concept, but an important one. People rule themselves, they have dominion over their behaviors. This is the simple reality of existence as a human being. I am in control of my own actions, and you are in control of your own actions. No one else can control what either of us choose to do. So you own your actions and I own mine. Because we are responsible for our choices and our actions, we are also responsible for the consequences of our actions. This has an effect in multiple directions. If I choose to start a business, then the consequence of the decision I made is that I own a business. If the business makes a lot of money, then I own the money the business results in. If the consequence is a successful business, then I own whatever the success brings me. No one has the right to take either the business from me or the money I made by starting the business. As one who owns my actions, I also own the consequences. Alternatively, let's say I start a business, I go into debt starting the business, and the business fails. I also own these consequences. I took a risk, it didn't work out, and now I am indebted to those who lent me money. I also own these consequences. I am responsible for my business, and the consequence is I now owe my creditors. No one has an obligation to forgive my debt, and no one should be forced to pay for the debt I accrued. I am also responsible for my actions when they hurt others. Let's say I am driving my car, and I don't see the light turn red. So I drive through the light and hit and kill a pedestrian. Even though I did not choose to kill this person, I am still responsible for my actions. I am responsible for the consequences of my actions, even when the result of my actions was unintended. I am then subjected to being held accountable for my error, and am responsible for trying to make things right in as much as it is possible. Self-ownership also involves morality. If, while driving the same car, I do see the light turn red, see the pedestrian, and then steer into them for the purpose of hurting them and they die, then I am not only responsible for the consequences of my actions, but I am responsible for the moral decision I made to take the life of another. In a free society, this means I am responsible for trying to make things right, but the consequences of my actions don't end there. In this case, the consequences of my decision to kill someone will also likely include my removal from society, as, depending on the circumstances, I have likely shown myself to be a dangerous and immediate threat to the existence of other human beings. I am responsible for the consequences of my immoral choices as well. People own the fruit of their labor. A natural corollary of self-ownership is people who own themselves also own what they produce. If people own their bodies, then they own what they do with their bodies. If people own themselves, then they also own their time. If people own their brains, then they own their ideas. People own what they create. A simple hypothetical may make this concept more tangible. If someone walks into an unowned forest, gathers up a bunch of branches lying on the forest floor, and out of those branches makes a chair, then the person owns the chair. The chair is the product of the person using their bodies, time, and brain to create something out of available resources. One who owns themselves also owns what they create. The same property rights which apply to one's own body also apply to the product of one's labor. In a sense, the chair becomes an extension of the chairmaker's body. As the chairmaker owns himself, he also owns the chair. The same property rights apply to the chair as to the chairmaker. No one has the right to destroy the chairmaker or the chair. No one has a right to take either him or what he created. To destroy the chair is to destroy what the chair maker owns, just as destroying him would be to destroy what he owns. Because the creator of the chair owns the chair, they can do whatever they like with it. If they would like to use it for themselves, they may. If they would like to give it away, trade the chair, sell it, then they have every right to do so. The one who used the earth's resources to create the chair owns it, and, as with their own body, may do with it whatever they wish, as long as they do not violate the non-aggression principle in the process. Of course, these property rights don't just apply to the finished product of the chair. Once the branches for the chair have had a person's labor invested in them, then they belong to the chair maker. Even the act of gathering the branches gives the branches value. For someone to take the collected branches would be to steal the product of another's labor. As we discussed in our conversation about the NAP, stealing someone's money from them is forcing them to work for free. Similarly, to take the branches is to force the chairmaker to labor on behalf of the thief for free. Stealing money and stealing gathered branches are both thefts of the fruit of someone else's labor. People who own the fruit of their labor can also choose to sell the fruit of their labor. This does not just mean they can sell their products, like a chair, but they can also sell their time and energy. Self-owned people have a right to choose to work for someone else and receive a wage in exchange. Perhaps the chair maker would prefer not to take on the risk of owning his own business. Instead, he would rather exchange time and labor for a financial remuneration from someone else who's perhaps better equipped in sales and distribution to help sell more chairs. If this is the case, obviously the chair maker doesn't own the chairs he makes, because he has chosen to sell the product of his labor for a wage. And finally, self-owned people own their relationships. People have a right to interact with others however they like, as long as their interactions do not violate the self-ownership of others. That is, if they are interacting voluntarily. If two people are interacting with each other without violating the NAP, then those people own their relationship. They are responsible for the relationship. They are in charge of their relationship. This applies to all sorts of relationships. Neighbors, friends, marriages, etc. Ownership of relationships also applies to economic relationships. If I sell something to you and you purchase it, then we just engaged in a voluntary economic relationship. We own all of the voluntary relationships we engage in, including economic transactions. People can engage in trade relationships with other people by exchanging something they own for something the other person owns. A cell phone person may exchange your time, labor, ideas, or the product of their labor for something of value another person has and is willing to exchange. The free and voluntary exchange between two cell phone parties is the basis for the common relationship of employee and employer we think of today. Obviously, no one owns the relationship other than the people who chose to enter into the relationship. These people may or may not want to include a third party to enforce the terms of the relationship, especially if it's contractual, but no third party can arbitrarily claim ownership over a voluntary relationship between self-owned people. Because no third party owns these relationships, no third party can justly interfere with them. Do you notice what is missing from all of these ideas about ownership and voluntary relationships? Rulers. If someone owns themselves, no one has the right to rule over their body. If someone owns themselves, then they own the consequences of their actions. If someone owns themselves, then they own what they create. And no one else has a right to rule over what they create. And if multiple self-owned parties engage in a relationship with each other, then no one has the right to rule over their interaction. Anarchy is about self-ownership. Government exists by exercising ownership over self-owned people. Everything the government does begins and ends with ruling over others. To rule over others is to own them. To rule over others is to tell them what they must and mustn't do with their own bodies, their actions, their property, and their relationships with others. The government owns the people it claims to rule. They violate the basic dignity of every individual they claim to own. If people are self-owned, then the government has no right to exercise ownership over them. I'll provide a brief example of how the government I live under, the U.S. government, violates these aspects of self-ownership. Government declares ownership over the bodies of its citizens. The simplest example of this in my current context are drug laws. Any law making a drug illegal is a violation of self-ownership. People who own their bodies have a right to put whatever they would like into their body. If they want to smoke marijuana, that's their right. If they want to snort crack, it is their body and they have a right to do so. If someone wants to inject something into their system which kills them immediately, it would be a tragic thing for them to do, but it is their body. The government exercises ownership by telling people what they can and can't put into their own body. They turn people into criminals who are merely exercising ownership. Of course, there are many drugs people probably shouldn't use. It's sad when people feel a need to do so. The abuse of substances should be discouraged in a society. However, to turn someone into a criminal because of what they decide to do to themselves is evil. If one is in charge of what another does to their body, then they own them. Government owns the very bodies of the people it rules. Government declares ownership over people's actions as well. Government often claims ownership over the positive consequences of people's choices, and we'll talk about that more in a little bit. Sometimes the government also takes ownership over the negative actions of people and the consequences of those actions. One example of this is the U.S. military. Every soldier in the military is a self-owned individual. These people choose to join an organization where they are sent to other countries and they kill people. In some cases, military action can be classified as the use of defensive force to protect those who are being aggressed against. In many cases, however, the soldiers in the military are violating the non-aggression principle when they go into other countries and use unjust force against others. They often destroy property and murder innocent bystanders. As long as they are just following orders, these self-owned people are not held accountable for their actions, even though their actions may be crimes against humanity. Instead, the government keeps them from being held accountable. The government shields them from responsibility by claiming ownership over their behavior. Thus, the individuals directly responsible for hurting others are not subjected to the negative consequences of their choices. Self-owned people are responsible for their decisions and the results of those decisions. But with the military, the government claims ownership over those choices. This creates an artificial disconnect between choice and consequence. The outcome is that soldiers become free to violate people without repercussions in ways they never could if the government did not take ownership of their violations of others. Government owns the fruit of the labor of its citizens. Start a business, pay taxes. Work for an employer, pay taxes. Buy property with the money you earn. Pay taxes on that property in perpetuity. Receive an inheritance, which is the fruit of someone else's labor. Pay taxes. A self-owned person owns all of what they have earned, were given, or purchased with what they earned. But the government claims ownership over the fruit of the labor of those it rules. The government relies on money to exist, and so it uses every opportunity it sees to take people's money. By taking from people what they earn, the government exercises ownership over them. The government uses force and the threat of force to assert ownership of the fruit of the labor of self-owned people. People labor, They take risks to start a business. They purchase property. They give gifts. But because they are owned by the government, the product of their labor is owned by the government. Like any thief, the government breaks the NAP to gain from the hard work and productivity of others. Again, self-owned people own the product of their labor, and the government only exists by violating that ownership through theft. Government also owns the relationships between self-owned people. A pertinent example right now is the minimum wage. There is currently widespread outcry for the minimum wage to be raised to $15 an hour. It is not currently my purpose to explain why this would be a pragmatically bad thing for the economy, although it would. Today I just want to point out that raising the minimum wage is a violation of self-owned people's voluntary relationships with each other. Let's say you own a business and you need someone to work for you to help you out. I choose to come work for you, and for whatever reason, we agree to a wage of $6 an hour. There are many reasons we may decide on this low wage. Perhaps I've never been employed before, or the work is really simple, or you can't afford more, or I can't find another job. It doesn't really matter why. You are a cell phone person, I am a cell phone person, and we have a right to agree to whatever wage we deem fair. I think I am benefiting because I chose to work for that wage, and you think you are benefiting because you chose to pay me that wage. If we both thought we would lose out, we would never agree to $6 per hour. We own this relationship. However, the government says we cannot engage in this relationship. The government claims ownership over our voluntary relationship and uses force to prevent me from working for you. They have no right to decide how we must and mustn't interact with one another. Yet they choose for us anyway because they rule us. They own us. The result is we both lose out. You can't hire me for a wage you believe to be beneficial to you, and I can't work for the wage I deem to be beneficial to me. You are out an employee, and I am out a job, because our self-owned relationships are owned by the state. Our basic human dignity, our basic right to interact with each other as we please, has been breached. Governments exist by violating the self-ownership of others. Governments use violence to exercise ownership over the people they rule. This isn't a new thing. People have been asserting ownership over other people since just after the time of the first sin. The world of human relationships entered a tailspin when Adam and Eve left the garden, and violence prevailed, being used as a means of controlling people. The first few chapters of Genesis make it clear that people were made to rule over the earth and have dominion over the plants and animals. There is no indication that people should ever rule over each other. The book of Genesis teaches that it is only because of sin that people rule over other people. The next few chapters of Genesis show the destructiveness of people ruling over others. These relationships of rule cause severe problems in the world. Soon after the first sin, we see people exercising ownership over other people and making the world a worse place to live. And it all begins with Adam and Eve's kids. In Genesis 4:1-16, Adam and Eve's firstborn son put on display the destructiveness of ruling over other people. I won't quote this particular scripture for the sake of time, and because I hope most listeners are familiar with the story. Cain was the firstborn son, and Abel the second. Both Cain and Abel gave an offering to God, and God was pleased with Abel's offering, but rejected Cain's. God made it clear to Cain that he didn't reject Cain, but just rejected Cain's offering. God's acceptance of Cain was not contingent on the offering, but on whether Cain did what was right. God's concern was for Cain to treat his brother Abel with dignity. God warned Cain the desire to do what was wrong was close to him, and that desire wanted to rule over Cain. Cain ignored God's words to him and embraced the sin which was after him. Cain was angry and disappointed, and so decided he did not want Abel to be freed to please God. Cain allowed sin to rule over him, and when sin ruled over him, Cain decided to rule over his brother. Cain exercised ownership over the body of his brother. He killed Abel. When we think of killing someone, we do not immediately equate it to ruling over someone. The perspective driving both rule and murder are the same. In the act of killing Abel, Cain, like any ruler, violated the self-ownership of Abel. Just as rulers and governments do, Cain declared that he owns Abel and then did with him as he wished, stealing his life from him. Abel did something Cain didn't want him to, so Cain killed him. Just as Cain did with his brother, governments exercise ownership over other people, threatening people with death if those people do not behave in a way the government wants them to. The violence that enters the world through Cain becomes increasingly problematic as the story of Scripture progresses. Many who come after Cain are even more apt to declare ownership over other people and use violence to enforce their ownership. A few generations after Cain, one of his descendants, named Lamech, reveals himself as one who will continue Cain's legacy of violent rule over others. We pick up the story in Genesis 4, verses 23 through 24. Lamech said to his wives, "Ada and Zillah, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, listen to what I say. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. Lamech is a man who prides himself on using violence against others. It is clear he has substantial power over other people. He insists upon getting vengeance far above and beyond any sort of justice. He probably has others who are under his rule who will aid him in his revenge. In Genesis 4:19, we learn he took two wives. While it is possible these wives wanted to marry Lamech and were happy to be with him, it is more likely that Lamech acquired these wives through power and force. In a world where women are ruled by their husbands and fathers, many times the acquisition of these women is also through rule. It is probable that either these women were owned by their fathers, treated like property, and sold to Lamech, or Lamech used his power over others to violently take these women and force them to be his wives. After the brief story of Lamech, there is a long genealogy in Genesis chapter 5. And we pick up in chapter 6 right where we left off, with rulers exerting ownership of others. The violent rule which started with Cain and worsened with Lamech continues in Genesis 6 and gets progressively more destructive. We are introduced to a group of violent despots who are very much like Lamech, but with more power, which means they do more to violate the self-ownership of others. Genesis 6, 1-2 says, "When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose." Scholars disagree as to what sons of God, more accurately in Hebrew, sons of the gods, refers to. Some think sons of God refers to angels who came to earth and had sexual relationships with females. Others think this term refers to the line of Seth at the end of chapter 4. Another group thinks sons of the gods was a term applied to local rulers who had acquired a lot of land and resources and used those resources to acquire power to rule over others. You will be unsurprised to learn I fall into this last category. Historically, from European monarchs to ancient Near Eastern despots, it is common to apply divine terms to local rulers. Often these local rulers will be called a son of God, or Zeus, or Thor, or Baal, or whatever the local god happens to be. It is not out of place for the author of Genesis to call these rulers sons of the gods. And it makes a lot more sense than the idea of bodiless and genderless spiritual beings thinking human females were so attractive they found a way to reproduce with them. Within the context of this passage, it is a more natural interpretation to assume these sons of God are humans who have godlike power. If this is the case, then the text is contrasting the terms sons of God and daughters of man. The author is deliberately displaying the power differential between these two groups to highlight the relative powerlessness of the daughters of man. The sons of God are using their superior power over others to take as many wives as they want. Their power is so substantial, they can acquire whatever women they find attractive to be their wives. While in the earlier passage with Lamech, there is some question as to whether he took wives by force, this passage is very clear. The sons of the gods were taking their wives by force. Whatever attractive wives they chose, they then acquired. The implication is it was irrelevant whether or not the women wanted to be their wives. These rulers took them anyway. They completely disregarded the self-ownership of these women. In the language of Scripture, the sons of God took wives. In our language, we would say that these rulers kidnapped and raped whatever women they wanted to. They had so much power, the men who cared about these women were powerless to stop them. As people exercised more and more ownership over others, the condition of human relationships in the world continued to degrade. The stronger rulers became, the more violence they used on others. The more violence they used on others, the more oppressed the powerless were. The first part of Genesis 6 tells a story about the growing violence in the world. The next part of Genesis 6 is a commentary on what the world had become. The author of Genesis says in verse 6:6, "The Lord saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually." The author goes on to make it clear how these evil intentions manifested on the earth. He says, "Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their ways on the earth. And God said to Noah, 'I have determined to make an end of all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them.'" The evil intentions of the heart are manifested in the violent actions of people against other people. People like the sons of God, who violate the dignity of other people, are running rampant. People across the world are treating other humans as if they are property. The entire earth is full of violence. Violence against others is an inherent violation of self-ownership. To use violence on someone else, or to threaten them with violence to get something from them, is to rule over them. It is to declare through action the person no longer owns themselves, is no longer in charge of their own body, but are owned by their ruler. If one uses violence to forcibly take a woman from her father and make her a wife, they have taken ownership of the woman. Her self-ownership is rendered impotent by her ruler. It is not fundamentally different for the one with superior power to use violence to get what he wants or to threaten violence to get what he wants. If one is using violence against someone to get what they desire or threatening violence, violence is still being used. Using violence and threatening violence are equal violations of the self-ownership of another. Threatening violence, rather than using it directly, may result in less people dying, but it is not an any less despicable act. Ruling over others with violence is evil, regardless of whether violence is actually used. In the case of the sons of God taking the daughters of man, whether the son of God takes the woman with force, or says to her, "You have to choose to become my wife, or I will use violence to destroy anyone who would protect you and then take you anyway," he is using violence against her. She may consent to his wish, but she was never given a real choice. She is essentially given three options. One, consent to the will of the man who wants her to become his wife. Two, be forced to become his wife. Or three, resist the man's physical and sexual violation to the point of death. These are not real choices. No one has a right to use coercion to give someone such options. The choices of the woman who is taken to be the wife of the local ruler are essentially the same choices any government gives its citizens. Granted, most people who have power in governments aren't using their power to rape people and take them as a spouse. However, although modern government rule is somewhat less despicable, this doesn't make government rule any more moral. Governments rely on the same violence and threats of violence to enforce any law they make. Every government law is an expression of preference backed with violence. In the case of the ruler and the daughter of man, his preference is that the woman come and marry him. If she does not go along with his preference, he will take her captive. In the case of the government, their expressed preference is any law they make. As an example, we could use any one of the hundreds of thousands of laws the government makes. Behind all of their laws is violence and the threat of violence. To illustrate this, we'll use a man who was found to possess marijuana as a pertinent hypothetical. In the region this man happens to reside in, the government's expressed preference is that no one should be allowed to possess marijuana. So the police, who discover the man had marijuana in his possession, tell the man to hand over the marijuana and request he turn around so they can immobilize his arms and put him in a cage. The police are the undergirding force of the expressed preference of the government. They are the violent arm of government. This violent arm enables the rulers to make sure people are living by their preferences. Like the local rulers of Genesis 6, it is well known the police are willing to use whatever force is necessary to make sure the desires of the government are adhered to. Therefore, when the police request the man possessing marijuana handed over and come with them, they are giving him the same three choices the rulers gave the women they wanted to be their wives. The man can consent to the request of the police. He can hand over his property and submit himself to whatever punishment the government deems necessary to help ensure other people adhere to their laws in the future. It is likely in these circumstances the man will choose to give in to their requests. The reason the man is likely to consent is because of the artificial limitations placed on his other choices by the willingness of the police to use violence. The second choice the man has is to decline their request and insist on his right to keep his own property and to not be locked up by someone else. If he tells them he does not consent to their preference for his behavior, then the most likely outcome is the cops will physically restrain him, take his property, handcuff him, and put him in a cage anyway. He will be subjected to their desires for him, although he does not share their desires for him and does not consent to their control of him. The man's third choice is to defend himself. This man may choose to exercise some of his basic human rights. He may choose to prevent the thieves in blue costumes from stealing his property, that is, the marijuana. No one has the right to use force and take someone else's property, and so the person who owns the marijuana has the right to prevent someone else from stealing it. The man may also choose to prevent himself from being taken and locked in a cage. If this man resists, with enough force, the attempts of the police to take his property and his person, they will kill him. The choices the woman has when dealing with the sons of the gods are the same choices the man who possesses marijuana has when dealing with the police. He may consent to their preferences. He can refuse to consent to what they want and be forced to do what they want anyway. having his basic human dignity violated. And his final choice is to resist to the point of death. No one should be allowed to put someone in the position this man is placed in. But it happens every day. The rulers in both of these circumstances are unable to violate other people by those who follow them and their willingness to use violence to violate others. The reason the local rulers in Genesis 6 were able to take whichever daughter of man they wanted is because the fathers of these women were unable to defend their daughters. Enough people were following the lead of their ruler and used violence on his behalf to take women to be his wives. So many people that the families of these women had no chance of protecting them. The willingness of many people to do what the rulers wish does not justify the behavior of the ruler. It doesn't matter at all how many people agree with what a ruler is doing, or how many people help the ruler accomplish his purposes. The number of people who agree on a course of action, or the percentage of people who agree on a course of action, has nothing to do with whether the course of action is ethical. A majority of people agreeing with them didn't make the ruler's behavior just then, and it doesn't make anyone's behavior just now. God certainly didn't care about the number of people who went along with the rulers. He called their behavior evil. These rulers in Genesis were making life for those who were not in power a living hell. The power differential between the rulers and the everyday people, and the use of this power over others to acquire whatever they would like, made the world a horrific place to live. God saw the destruction of the violent rule of others, and he was greatly grieved by it. He never wanted to create a world where violence was everywhere. He never wanted to create a world where people were owned by other people. Genesis is clear. The reason God sent the flood was the ubiquitous violence of humanity. In light of these realities, it is not unfair to say God sent the flood because people were ruling over other people, and these relationships of rule were destroying the world. Humanity was never intended to rule over each other. People ruling over other people destroys people and the world around them. For the follower of Jesus, there are many behaviors we recognize to be dishonoring of God. Many sins outside of using violence on others are prevalent in the lives of Christians and in the lives of those who are not. Scripture informs us it is not due to any of these sins, but due to the sin of violence, God hit the reset button on creation. People using force and the threat of force to rule over other people resulted in the flood. Given this, we should be sure not to initiate violence on others. In addition, we should not support violence on others to prevent the occurrence of other sins. As outlined earlier, any government law requires violence to be enforced. Therefore, in order to use government laws to legislate Christian morality, Christians are using violence to control the lives of others. When Christians use the government to create and enforce laws to punish people for their sin, they become guilty of the very same sin of violence which led to the flood. After the flood occurred and the population increased again, the stories of Scripture show us the new local rulers of the region are not much different than they were prior. Many people still seek to acquire power, and those who have power to control the lives of others often choose to do so. Rulers of the region are still violating the self-ownership of others and instilling fear into those who are less powerful than them. We can easily infer this from some stories about Abraham and his descendants. Abraham has multiple run-ins with local rulers, which show us even after the flood, the local rulers still act like Cain, Lamech, and the sons of gods discussed earlier. They treat people as their own property. Abraham and his wife once go to live in a place ruled by a pharaoh of Egypt, and another time to a ruler named Abimelech. On both occasions, Abraham does the same thing. he and his wife Sarah pretend they are siblings. They do this because Abraham is afraid these rulers will kill him and take his wife as their own. Instead of him ending up dead and the ruler taking his wife as his own anyway, Abraham decides to skip over the being dead part and gives his wife to them without struggle. This is not an honorable course of action, but it shows the sense of helplessness they felt. His actions reflect a very real fear and expectation these rulers will exert ownership over him and over his wife. These rulers are very much like the sons of the gods and are making the world a similarly unjust place to live. If you're interested in reading the stories I mentioned, they're all in Genesis, and they all go pretty much the same. You have the story of Abraham and Pharaoh in Genesis 12, 10 through 20, Abraham and Abimelech in Genesis 20, 1 through 18, and Isaac, who is Abraham's son, gets into a very similar situation with a guy named Abimelech a generation later in Genesis 26, 1 through 12. These stories reflect the fears of people living in the ancient Near East. They are afraid that the powerful rulers will do what rulers do, contravene the self-ownership of others. It was a terrible thing in the world then, and it is terrible now. Some of the worst parts of our world exist because of people exerting ownership over other people. Why would we want to live in a world where people are owned by someone other than themselves? How can we support a world like this and maintain our integrity? I don't want to live in such a world. I don't think we can support it, and I won't. With that happy and joyful exhortation, let's conclude this episode. Thank you for listening to me today. Again, please contact me with any questions or comments or rebuttals. I would love to hear all of them. You can email me at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. You can call or text 715-201-2722. Or you can follow me on Twitter, and my username is @jeremiahjm. So long. Farewell. Auf Wiedersehen. Goodbye.